I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. In recent election cycles, as you probably know, national pollsters have gotten it pretty wrong, drastically underestimating Donald Trump in 2020. People do pay attention to the polls as those elections draw close, but there is a sense that you can't trust the numbers. So here's a change. This year, Franklin and Marshall College got it right. They called the race here in Pennsylvania almost perfectly, putting now President-elect Trump at 50% and his opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, at 49%. I recently sat down with Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall, to get his reaction.
We're excited. I should say probably not surprised that we did well. but hey, look, when you're pulling random samples of voters, it can always go a bit haywire. So I wouldn't say there's too much luck involved, but we breathe a sigh of relief that we were as close as we were.
Now, if my research is correct, back in 2020, your October poll, your final poll, had Joe Biden leading Donald Trump about 50-44. Is that right?
I believe that's right. Yeah.
That was an overestimate of Biden and an underestimate of Trump. So why do you think your model did better this time?
I think 2020 was a tough year for pollsters in general. You know, we're not exactly sure why, but I think just in general, the pandemic sort of made it very difficult to know. And of course, the introduction of mail-in balloting made it really difficult to know that year who was likely to go to the polls. And I think just across the board and for us as well, it was just difficult to estimate what the electorate was going to look like on election day.
And we're kind of early in postmortem now, but do you think at this point now that you got this good result in 2024, that 2020 really was a pandemic-related miss and not something deeper about the model? Like, is that what your gut's telling you right now?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think for us, you know, we have a pretty streamlined and simple likely voter model, and we don't really report the likely voter model for most of the fall. You know, so when we're normally reporting out, say, in August or September, we're still looking just mostly at registered voters because things can shift. And it's really just at the end there in October where we rely on the likely voter model. And that model is pretty simple. It asks voters how certain they are to vote and how much interest they have in the campaign. And we take those that say they are certain to vote and very interested in the campaign, and those are our likely voters.
And that made a huge difference for you all this time, because if you just went with registered voters, your final poll, I think, would have had Harris ahead of Trump by like 4 points. So that would have been a big miss.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there was some talk at the time that a big turnout would have been really good for Harris. And, you know, I think our poll bears that out, that if turnout had been higher this year, she may have done even better. We'll never know for sure. And it may have been that if there was even higher turnout, Trump would do even better. Because part of what's been difficult for the last three election cycles or the last three presidential election cycles is capturing those hardcore Trump voters.
Yeah.
And all pollsters have had a difficult time doing that. So, and actually, for the last couple of cycles, our likely voter model has been pretty good. So that doesn't quite explain, you know, what happened in 2020. We weren't that far off on modeling the electorate. Again, 2020 was a very strange year, and I think we chalked that up to the pandemic. But our likely voter model has been pretty good, and it served us well this year, for sure.
For 8 years now, it feels like pollsters have been trying to get their arms around the Trump effect on the electorate, on response rates to pollsters. Do you feel like, hey, at F&M, we've finally gotten there? We've gotten our arms around this thing, and we sort of understand what the Trump effect is?
I hope so. You know, I mean,
You're not ready to claim victory yet.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just been so strange. The polls nationally have been really, really good in midterm election years,
right.
So in 2018 and 2022. Even in 2016, it wasn't quite as bad. You know, the polling miss was about 2 points.
Right.
So we can take some comfort here that we got Pennsylvania right. But, you know, part of that is we understand the state, and I should give a lot of credit to the director of the poll, Burwood Yost.
Right.
But, you know, we know the state really, really well. And so I think a lot of times when people drop into a state and do some polling, they don't really understand the dynamics as well. And that's why state polls can often be way off. But look, if Trump was on the ballot again 4 years from now, which of course he can't be, you know, who knows what would happen. I mean, he's just a unique figure, and his impact on the electorate is just really hard to understand and to model. So
It's
he just
confounding. It
has,
really is.
it really is, and it suggests he has a kind of magnetism that he can get voters to the polls that we just can't reach. Because, look, if people aren't that interested in politics, why would they answer a survey? But he has the ability on election day to get those people to the polls. And that's just really unique in American politics. And
It
so
used to be that
it.
there wasn't much of a delta, or at least not a partisan delta, between who's going to respond to a pollster and who is actually going to get their butt to a poll in November. But for whatever reason, when Donald Trump runs, there is a real delta between those two things, a real difference.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, look, in some ways, the fact that polls miss people who are disengaged and not interested in politics at all, that's helpful to the pollsters because we're trying to simulate the electorate, right? And so people who ordinarily don't pay any attention at all and are disengaged, well, they're not going to end up voting. So missing them hasn't really been a problem for pollsters before the Trump era. Now, those same voters, many of them are likely to vote.
Yeah.
And most of those are likely to vote for Trump. So missing them is a huge problem.
So this year, do you feel like you reached those people or you were just able to tweak the weights in your model to account for them?
I mean, we do a pretty good job of reaching them because one of the other pieces of this is that there are so many different methodological approaches just to trying to get access to voters. So some people are reaching out by phone. We use an address-based sampling model. So we know all of the addresses in the state, and we can randomly select from those addresses and then mail a postcard that says, you know, we can call you or you can go online and do it. And that address base means we're reaching people who may be, you know, really hard to reach in other ways. So I do think that's a better model for sampling people, and it hasn't been widely used for a lot of pollsters this cycle. And so that may be part of it, is we were able to reach people. What motivates them to say, sure, I got this postcard, this sounds interesting, I'll answer the survey. You know, it's we can't make them, unfortunately. I wish we could make the people that we randomly selected do our surveys and do our polls, but we can't. So this year, they may have been more motivated than they might have been in the past to respond.
I want to give the polls credit for something here. Your final October poll had Senator Bob Casey leading challenger Dave McCormick 49 to 48. And that's going to be slightly off, but still pretty darn close. And the entire cycle, I was seeing these polls showing swing state Democrats who are running for Senate consistently running ahead of Kamala Harris. And I thought this cannot be real. But state after state after state, it did turn out to be a real thing. You all captured that in your poll, and many others did as well. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, a lot of these swing state Senate races, not all of them, but many of them, you know, you're talking about incumbents and you're talking about well-known incumbents. People know them and by and large like them. And so you would expect, I think, that they were going to run ahead of Harris. Now, you know, probably not by a lot, because politics is nationalized in a lot of ways. And so, you know, people are generally voting for their party's nominees kind of up and down the ballot. And they're making those decisions based on national political considerations. So they should have been pretty close. But the fact that the incumbent senators, who by and large were pretty popular in their states, that would explain that. And I think it's borne out.
But they weren't all incumbents. Like in Michigan, it was a
Yeah, that's true.
non-incumbent, and the same phenomenon played out. In Arizona, we had two non-incumbents against each other. But again, the Democrat did way better than Kamala Harris ended up doing. It felt like the polls were reaching this group of people who were going to vote for Donald Trump and perhaps
Yeah.
leave their ballots blank or vote actively for the Democrat for Senate. That was impressive to me that polls were seemingly consistently reaching those people.
Yeah, and I think there was just enough of them, and the polls were able to reach them that said, you know, look, if I am going to vote for Trump, then I'm going to vote for a balance in the Senate. And, you know, as long as we can pick up a fraction of those, because when we're talking about razor thin margins, you know, you don't need a lot of people in your poll to come up with that result. And so you know, the polls, I think, were capturing just enough of those people who said, yeah, I think I'm going to split my ticket this year just to ensure that kind of balance, you know, in the national government. And that's rare. It's still not very many people who do that,
Yeah.
but we captured them, and I think it's borne itself out.
So you probably haven't even thought about this yet, but I'm curious now, moving forward, do you preemptively tweak your model to account for the fact that Trump's going to leave the ballot, or do you just sort of let it ride and see if an error emerges after we have another national election?
No, I don't think it was tweaked that much to adjust for Trump. I mean, I think again, 2020 was rough for all pollsters. One of the things pollsters did this year, for example, is that many pollsters, about two-thirds of pollsters apparently, were weighting their results on the recalled vote from 2020. In other
Yeah,
words, they were
asking people,
asking
who did
people
you vote for last time?
exactly. And the idea was people tend to overreport voting for the winner. They just sort of they don't quite remember, but they like to be with a winner, so they say, "Oh, I voted for Biden," even if they didn't. So the effect of that then would have been to reduce the results for Harris, and to increase, statistically boost the results for Trump. And lots of pollsters thought that they were going to account for the Trump effect by doing that.
Yeah, didn't work.
Apparently, it didn't work.
Yeah.
We never did that. We don't do that sort of thing. We wait for a number of factors, including partisanship, and we know the registered voter numbers in the state, and we wait for, region of the state and a whole bunch of other things. And I think our weighting approach is sound, and I think so is our sampling method. I mean, we didn't really change anything to try to adjust to Trump. And the fact that we got it, close this time, really close. Maybe spot on, means we're not going to switch anything up going forward.
Yeah. I believe you've been at Franklin and Marshall since 2002. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, how do you describe the way public interest in polling has changed over those 22 years? Like the reaction you get when you put out a poll, what you hear from people, et cetera.
I mean, I think there's just a lot more skepticism. Some of the things you hear, we've heard forever, which is, how can they capture attitudes when I've never been called to do a poll? And so you sort of have to explain to them the science of sampling. It's a mystery to people, and so that's not changed. But the reports of polling errors have made people a lot more skeptical. I do think that's been unfair, because even in 2016, I think the takeaway from 2016 is the polls got it wrong, when in fact the polling miss in terms of margin was what the historical averages are. It's just that the direction was wrong, right? Clinton was leading in the polls and Trump ended up winning, although she won the national popular vote, and that's what polls are really trying to replicate. Really, the big miss was 2020. And so polls are pretty accurate, but the perception is they're not. And so there's lots of skepticism about polling. And that, I think, is problematic, because a lot of what we try to do at FNM and what I think good pollsters do is gather information that's not just the horse race, which candidate is winning and which one's losing, but tries to help explain why. What are attitudes about the economy? What are motivating people's votes? How enthusiastic are they to vote? And so if we can explain behavior with polls, I think that's a valuable service. But if people just trust polls across the board, then we're going to have a harder time
Does it actually
contributing to.
affect how accurate the polls end up being, you think? Because then you have people who distrust, and perhaps then when they get that postcard in the mail saying to participate, they go, eh, no thanks. That stuff is bunk.
Maybe. I mean, look, response rates have been plummeting, for years, and that it's just harder to reach people, which is another reason why the address-based sampling is really valuable, because they get a postcard in the mail, and I think people feel, I would hope people feel like they sort of like they won the lottery. Okay, so finally a pollster wants to hear from me, and so they're, that may make them more willing to do it,
You got
but
to
I
show
don't
up at people's
know.
door with a big check, like Publishers Clearinghouse. That's the way to get
Yeah,
them really excited.
exactly.
That was Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. You can listen to Studio 2 live on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at noon on WHYY. Our show is produced by Paige Marie Bessler, Debbie Builder, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's Studio 2 Extra. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, and thanks so much for joining me.